Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, as TalkTV moves online and GB News reveals dire finances, we look back at the health of the startup news channels. Also on the programme, Global looks to STV's boss to lead the company. What challenges are ahead for the UK's biggest commercial radio group? All that plus whether journalists are too narrow-sighted when reporting the news. And in the media quiz, we play radio battleships. That's all to come in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, the European Union has fined Apple €2 billion for banning music streamers like Spotify from informing iOS users about cheaper music services available outside the app. Spotify said the fine sends a powerful message, whilst Apple will appeal the ruling. Britain's largest newspaper group, Reach, released its results for last year on Tuesday. Digital revenues had the biggest fall after fewer referrals from Facebook and Google searches. But the publisher has reduced its funds for future claims as a result of phone hacking trials after Prince Harry's trial judgment. And Doctors, the long-running drama, has had its final day of filming. That was last Friday. A screenwriter, Philip Ralph, said that the series had given opportunity and experience to writers like himself, as well as actors and crew, and the decision to close the show was disastrous. Of course, we at the Media Podcast have been going in some form since 2005, when Doctors was still finding its feet. Joining me, Crystal Lockery, editor of Pop Bitch. What were you doing in 2005?
Oh, God. I'm taking my first steps into the adult working world, I think.
Like many of the people on Doctors, yeah. Really. Jake Cantor, investigations editor at Deadline. What were you doing in 2005?
I was in the second year of university, okay. Living my best life.
You were just haven't emerged yet as a media entity.
I mean, you're nearly 20 years old. I mean, that's a magnificent achievement.
It is, in lots of different forms, like Doctor Who, the show has evolved.
Regenerating.
Yes, absolutely. And who knows if that might happen next. Certainly not me. So what have you both been up to this week? Jake?
We've just been discussing off air. I've been kept busy by a story that I've been working on for a little while. It's about agents in the TV and film world misleading their clients and sending them fake audition invites. It's quite an industry story, but it means a lot to the 98%. And when I say the 98%, I mean actors who make up the majority of the profession, but are not stars, not Hollywood stars. And they are being misled by their agents, and people feel very, very strongly about it, and people are very upset.
And since putting it out, have you had lots of follow-ups from other people about similar things?
Yes. I think inevitably when you touch on a sort of a nerve like this, people tend to reflect on their own auditions, go and do some digging themselves, and sometimes get in touch with me and say, hey, I've had some fake tapes as well.
The fake tape story. And Chris, what's been keeping your inbox on fire this week?
Mostly thanks to Jerry Halliwell, the F1 Red Bull Christian Horner story. So
it doesn't seem to stop. There seems to be
doesn't seem to stop. And the there's sort of strange errors. It's constantly evolving. So last week, shortly after you'll have recorded, a cache of anonymous texts were emailed out to F1 journalists and others, seemed to give evidence in this case that's been brought against Christian Horner for inappropriate workplace conduct. He was cleared from an independent investigation last week. Within 24 hours, then, this evidence made its way into the inboxes of journalists and F1 bosses. And the story's kind of snowballed from there. What's been interesting is that anyone with any interest in the story has probably come across the link and read the alleged messages. And yet the journalists covering it are in a difficult position because there is absolutely no guarantee that these messages are what they say they are. Could be a very sophisticated hoax. There's just no telling. And what's interesting about that from a sort of like media law perspective is depending on who's leaked those texts really changes
the legality of it all, really, I suppose.
Really changes the legality of it all, yeah.
If it's been grabbed or participants got involved, I suppose.
But yeah, and it's to do with his privacy being invaded. If the leaks have come from the accuser, then their right to their Article 10 right to freedom of expression probably would outweigh Christian Horner's Article 8 right to privacy. If it was anybody else, then his right to privacy probably trumps their right to freedom of expression. So once again, we're in this position of law.
It's an issue for a sort of salacious story, but that's
I mean, there's also just like, ooh, Jerry Halliwell had to walk out on her heels, and out in Bahrain. So there's all that kind of salacious side to it too, and some of the messages are they're on the verge of being mucky, so there's a kind of there's a salacious element to it too.
Always a bit of interest in that too.
Oh, it's a media adjacent story, which is brilliant for me because I get to read and devour it and not have to write about it. Which is brilliant. Yeah. And it, of course, it's all made more pronounced by the Netflix show. That's created a soap opera around F1, and this is like the perfect storyline for that soap opera.
It is interesting whether they cover it, how they cover it. Okay, after a few weeks of speculation, Talk TV is to stop broadcasting and move solely online. It was announced this week. Jake, this follows Piers Morgan's announcement a few weeks ago that he was sort of off to YouTube. He sort of tried to get out before I guess this big news dropped. What does it mean?
Well, I wonder how much warning Piers had and whether he was allowed to save a bit of face. Look, I think since his announcement a couple of weeks ago that he was moving to YouTube, I think the writing has been on the wall for Talk TV. It was just a matter of when, not if. I think it shows that that this is a rare Murdoch misfire. There is a feeling at News UK that that they should have stuck to their guns and gone with the original plan, which was to launch online and for it to be a streaming service. They kind of reacted to GB News and have lost the battle of the sort of right-wing news stations.
What a terrible war to be in and then to lose on top of that.
I think even though the news was expected, I think it was a difficult all-staff meeting. I think I've been told there were some tears. But insiders are equally not surprised. I mean, you know, the resource has been sort of leached out of the station for a little while. And the idea of it becoming a YouTube-only station is a bit of a fig leaf for, a slow wind down.
Hey, Chris, when I was looking at the statement that the Scott Tawton, the head of broadcasting, said, there's some of it that I sort of buy into, which is it hasn't really worked for a variety of reasons. But actually what they've been left with is quite interesting infrastructure, the ability to actually accelerate what they can do at The Sun or The Times or their other radio stations.
Yeah.
I mean, this is sort of publisher's dilemma, isn't it? How far you go into digital away from your regular business. And people kind of blow hot and cold with that, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I read that email and first pass, I thought, there's a lot of this makes a lot of sense, you know, very, very rational sort of business decision here. But then when I was thinking about it, I'd sort of forgotten that it's only really started less than 2 years ago. Mm. And they're talking as if the change in viewer habits, listener habits has suddenly crept up on them in the last 18 months. But people have been, you know, digesting news through their phones for the best part of a decade now. Mm. And then suddenly on second read, I thought, yeah, this is very face-saving. Really, they basically, yes, as you say, misfired, and they should have really launched online. The idea of doing this linear, they said they didn't feel brave enough, was the phrase, not to launch without a linear presence.
Broadcast TV, yeah.
Yeah, it's obviously been an expensive mistake of theirs to sort of hang on to that heritage presentation, yeah. You know.
They've invested very heavily in the studio space there. And I've been there. Yeah. It's a really impressive operation. Mm. And if they can repurpose that and service other brands like The Sun, increase the video content around Times Radio, then it won't have been a disastrous venture.
Obviously, what they were fighting against was GB News, and at some point talks about mergers or takeovers. But sort of within minutes of their announcement, news about GB News continuing to be a sort of financial basket case, if you look at it in the traditional sense. They talked about it being able to break even in year three. How's that looking?
Unlikely.
But does it matter?
I don't think it does. No. I think it's a very expensive hobby for Paul Marshall. And, you know, he is clearly of a mind to gain some influence in the media agenda. You know, there's lots of speculation about him wanting to buy the Telegraph and the Spectator. But in GB News, he has managed to cultivate a brand that, although it's incredibly chaotic in its launch, is now a genuine force within the news space.
It reaches about 2.7 million people, I think, over a month.
It's more than that now. It's consistently getting over 3 million reach a month.
Online views are up.
Yeah. But again, also, as an agitator in the space as well, it's, you know, that's where a lot of its real value lies, because, you know, whether people watch it or don't, it makes headlines in and of itself. Certainly, you know, the caliber of politician they're luring away from the Commons to host on that show, you know, completely undermines their positioning as like the underdog channel. But, you know,
I mean, they've become the establishment.
Yeah. I mean, quite literally. The power that presents, whether you're getting eyeballs on it or not, there is a great deal of heft there. And for the amounts they're putting in, what is it, 41 million, I think, the parent company put in last year. You know, there's a case to be made for that being a fairly decent investment. I mean, probably not at the minute because the way the election's going.
But also, they're going to be in a great position post-election if the polls are to be believed and the Conservatives don't do so well. The sort of GB News flavour of the Conservative Party becomes incredibly strong and they become the leader in that. I mean, it's sort of a Sir Paul Marshall equivalent of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I feel, because you've got GB News, you've got Unheard, which sometimes people forget that he owns, and Telegraph is still a little bit up in the air. It seems to be with Redbird, but they might have to do something with it. I mean, that's what he's after, to be a sort of right wing kingmaker.
Yes, I mean that's you know. I think that's probably partly the aim. I don't know. He's a bit of a mysterious figure. We don't know much about him. And, you know, I saw the news agents a couple of weeks ago managed to get hold or get access to his Twitter account, in which he was liking and retweeting some, you know, fairly extreme views. It's clear that there is a bigger gain than financial one. And there has to be, because GB News' revenues were, what, about £6 million, which is, you know, paltry, really. And I don't see a way in which that's going to increase significantly. I was watching it on Budget Day and, you know, prime time for a channel like GB News. The advertising was there, but they still don't have blue chip advertisers. Mm. And I don't see that changing significantly in the coming years.
So the Ofcom chair, she said something which Ofcom kind of don't hear it said out loud about them not having to pay as much attention to GB News as they would, say, a traditional broadcaster. Why is that?
So, when I first read the remarks, I raised my eyebrows, just like you. But actually, it is backed up by the code, and content has to be justified by its context. And I think if you've got more viewers, that means more responsibility. And that means that greater scrutiny will potentially be applied to the likes of the BBC, Channel 4, ITV, as opposed to GB News in this example, which has a much smaller audience.
I mean, Chris, it feels like we've got sort of these odd partial news channels sort of by the back door. It says news on the top, but really is a current affairs, so they're regulated in a different way. This genie isn't going back in the bottle anytime soon, is it?
No, and it seems that it's going a bit fractal as well. So this week, as Dan Wotton announced that he was going to be starting his own independent media concern. This is after he officially left GB News This week.
That's to combat, what he called the off-communists.
The off-communists, exactly. Much more of that absolutely red-hot wordplay coming your way soon on Dan Wotton Outspoken, I believe is the one he's gone for. But I saw today as well, I think Lawrence Fox and Calvin Robinson are launching their own thing. Talk about the Marvel universe. Yes. They released a trailer for it. It looked like something Guy Ritchie would have done at university. It was the two of them sort of smoking cigars, blowing lots of lens flare and stuff, the two of them. Calvin Robinson giving the sort of sign of the cross. Outspoken Fox and Father, or Father and Fox it's called. Oh, and they're gonna do, so it seems like all the people that have left GB News for one reason or another are looking to set up their own kind of challenges to that orthodoxy. So
I mean, you're much better chance of making some money as sort of individuals doing something than you are by being a large organization. And you see in America, where there's obviously a lot of support for this kind of content and media, I always feel that the assumption from that sort of group of people in the right wing is that there are more people who are interested in it than there actually are.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they'll get a, when it's their own finances on the line, they'll get a rude awakening, I'm sure. I think Wotton had a slight taste of it himself when he tried to crowdfund his legal response and didn't get quite the response he was hoping for.
I mean, the Met have cleared him, but it's one element of a much wider story.
Yeah, the police have decided, or two police forces have decided, there is no evidence of criminal wrongdoing. That doesn't sort of alleviate any of the issues that were there to do with workplace harassment, bullying, interpersonal relationships in the workplace. A lot of alleged behavior regarding that sort of still stands. He may not face court as a result of it or any sentence, but that doesn't exonerate him completely. And there's an interesting legal tactic being deployed. We've seen it used in other places where you send some letters out. So Dan Wotton has sent letters to The Guardian, and The Guardian have withdrawn an article and offered to pay towards his legal costs as a result. This is to do with naming him ahead as part of an active police investigation, which I think certain commentators and institutions maybe did get a little carried away in thinking what they could publish about this in the heat of the moment when there was some momentum behind the story. And The Guardian have relented and said, yes, they were wrong to do that. They're using a very recent legal case, Bloomberg one, that 2002, I think it was, to say that, you know, people are entitled to a degree of privacy regarding ongoing police investigations, and that he should never have been named ahead of the decision that they took. That has been sort of cynically used, I would argue, to sort of give him total vindication, total exoneration from everything he's been accused of. So using that to say, you see, this was all just a big witch hunt. This was all nonsense. It was politically motivated smear.
And also,
while it's true that you know, the Guardian feel that they've misstepped in naming him ahead of time, you know, that's all that proves, really. Nothing more.
Moving on, Global, the media company, are going to have a new CEO next year. And Jake, it's Simon Pitts, who's currently the boss of STV. Yes. What do we know about him?
Well, Simon has been at STV for about 6 years. You know, STV is a very, you know, pretty healthy broadcaster. He's steered it through the pandemic. I think the thing that he has done, which is really impressive, is he has grown STV Studios, which is the production arm, into a, you know, a genuinely you know, respectable force in the production industry. You know, it makes shows for Apple, including Criminal Record, which has got Peter Capaldi in. You know, it used to trade off shows like Antiques Road Trip. Not that there's anything wrong with Antiques Road Trip,
but Taggart
is painting Taggart. Yeah, is painting on a slightly bigger scale these days, and is a, you know, is a, you know, is a bit more international in its focus. And I think we were a bit surprised to see Simon going. We thought he might go to ITV. He's gone to Global. He's a, you know, he's a very imposing figure, and when I say that, I mean he's literally really tall. he's very affable. He's a smart guy, and I think Global is a great move for him. I think the question with Global is, how much autonomy does he have? Maybe this is a better question for you.
What do you mean?
Surely Ashley pulls the strings there, right? I mean, it might turn the spotlight on you, Matt.
Yeah, so you've got the owner of that business, and he's sort of really the total owner, Ashley Tabor King, who's helped establish it. I mean, interestingly, you know, Simon's predecessor, very strong personality too, and working with Ashley, they've had a very successful relationship. As I understand it, there's not lots of discussion from other people about what that organisation should do. It's pretty much driven from the top. And I guess Simon has to work out whether he's going to be a collaborator with Ashley on defining that, or whether he's more about instigating the boss's desires, which, you know, if you own it, you get to decide, don't you?
Yes. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, look, Simon is clearly, he's part of the high profile media executives in the UK now. My instinct is that he won't have gone there to just be a yes man to Ashley. Mm. I suspect if he's, you know, got grander designs on bigger jobs in the industry, he will want to make his mark there in his own way.
Absolutely. We'll be back with more media news after this.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back. Chris and Jake are still here with me. Chris, we were talking a bit there about sort of Dan Wootton and Substacks. I mean, oddly, Potbitch is sort of the original email newsletter, the kind of original email media newsletter.
It's one of the, yeah, it's longest standing at least. It's 24 years, yeah.
And
it's
looks very similar to it did at that point.
Yeah, yeah, still looks like old typewriter ticker tape stuff. I don't know, yeah, it's been a strange journey because you go through phases where people tell you that newsletters are in again and then they disappear, everybody pivots to video, then everybody stops pivoting to video and says newsletters are back in. Then everybody tries to start linear TV again, and then it's back to newsletters. I think
what is it about the newsletter that has survived this long?
I think what's interesting about the newsletter and what's useful about it is that it's still a very personal connection. Mm-hmm. So even if it is written and sent out to tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of subscribers, you still feel like you're receiving it yourself. It's come to you personally. So I think that's, people develop quite a strong relationship with that. The costs to getting started are very minimal. It's just you need an email address, really. I mean, there are systems if you want to make it pro. Yes. There's a few going on. So you can professionalize that. But really, the barrier to entry is fairly small. So that means that people, journalists, writers, even non-journalist writers who want to start building something, start writing something, can. And they can find an audience and they can grow that audience. You just circumvent the usual kind of gatekeepers of that.
Obviously, quite a lot of the people who are kind of going to the more Substack world are looking at that ability to charge people and that kind of mixture of free and fee. Mm-hmm. On the Potbitch side, it's been always very much on the free end.
Yeah.
And you must have thought about, do we add subscription features over the years?
Yeah, we do. We have a sort of a little premium tier where we do stuff like that. People that support us send us a nominal fee, £4 a month, if anyone's interested in signing up for Club Hopfish. But, you know, and they will get an extra newsletter and a few other bonuses and stuff like that. You know, that's a really, it's an easy way for people who really want to support your work, which there are a lot of people want to do that sort of thing and would be glad of the opportunity to do it if that functionality is there. I think that has become more and more prevalent in recent years, and that means that people say on Substack or Tiny Letters just gone, but there's a Beehive, a number of these services that have opened that allow that and allow people to monetize it. And I don't think audience begrudged paying it because it's not ad supported. You know, so many of the news websites are so flooded with advertising. It's very difficult to read what you want to read. You're forever kind of changing your GDPR settings, clicking endless things to get rid of cookies. You don't really get any of that with newsletters. And what that's good as well then for advertisers because, you know, people install ad blockers on their web browsers, which means that they don't see a lot of the stuff that is the lifeblood of a lot of these publications. They, you know, it's their main source of income. And it gets denied them. But you can't really do that with a direct-to-inbox newsletter. So it does solve a lot of the problems that journalism is facing. It's just the scale of it, really, and the fact that it does compartmentalize everything into lots of small niche products, which means on one hand, you get to compile your own newspaper in that sense. So the old method was that you would buy the newspaper, you'd find the sections you like, you'd bin the rest, you'd read entertainment, you'd read sports, you'd throw anything hard in the bin. And you can do that with newsletters, but they can come from all over the place. I guess the trouble is that people need to then find a way to make that work for them financially.
And the scale thing's interesting, isn't it? Because it's something that sort of supports the smaller business in scope. I don't imagine there's hundreds of you at Potbitch headquarters putting it out each week.
No, absolutely not. No, there's yeah, me and one other person, yeah.
But I imagine over the years there's been a view of like, should we pivot to video, or should we build out a web property, or should we trade on that name to grow it?
Yeah, and we have done various projects. I remember when iPad publishing was going to be the big savior of journalism, we had a digital, you know, Padlet offering, which is good. It allowed us to write longer things, and we ended up folding that into some of the newsletter stuff. Gave us the chance to sort of spread our wings and try that a bit. People don't really use the app store to get their news in the way that, you know, people predicted they did.
There's an interesting bit about like relationships with publications like yours. I was talking to someone who'd set up a kind of Patreon for their project, and they were quite obsessed with what all the levels would be, and they'd made some like merch for one of the levels and then launched it. A lot of people went for that level. No one was bothered sending the address in to get the merch, because actually what they were doing was supporting the creator rather than worrying about getting the pencil.
If anyone decides to go into that kind of Patreon, I remember doing this with a Kickstarter once as well, spending so much time. That was absolutely the biggest time drain of the whole project, was figuring out the rewards and what to make and not to make too many of them so that you're stuck with box after box of t-shirts that you can't shift or anything like that. And, you know, it actually probably took away from time that was probably better spent on figuring out what the product was, actually writing that. So that's a trap people fall into. And I think, audiences are fairly forgiving, or at least they don't need a huge amount. They do, if you have that relationship with your readers, then they like to be able to support it. They like to feel that they're keeping you independent, or, you know, making sure that they have a stake in what they're reading, which is really cool. It's something that, you know, shouldn't be taken for granted, but is an incredibly interesting part of the modern media landscape.
And it also sort of media bifurcates slightly, doesn't it? Because on one hand, you've got, say, the New York Times, who want to sort of be everything, from cooking to product reviews to news, and do a very good job of that. And at the other end, you've got people like yourself who are sort of picking one smaller area to sort of super serve. If you're sort of trapped in the middle, are they the journals or publishers that are going to find it more difficult? And we, you know, think about something like Reach, and Reach have had a lot of trouble recently trying to be a bit of something for everyone in the middle.
I guess we'll find out fairly soon, because they are struggling. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned the New York Times, and a lot of people describe it as a puzzle book that has a huge news wing. You know, lots of people play Wordle and probably do without realizing it's part of this larger media. You know, their cooking stuff is hugely popular. People will just go for that. Were they to try and build that without having the New York Times behind it, it would be very hard to organically create something like that. Not impossible. People have done it, but
more of a challenge.
Much more of a challenge. And you also don't want to spread your own product too thinly. Otherwise, you only end up with people, there for the puzzles. Which, when you used to sell papers as a big bundle, that's fine. You've got everybody in and you've got them buying the entire paper. If you break that up too much and offer, you know, puzzle subscriptions, and that ends up being your bread and butter, it's not as expensive as what it costs to send people out and have bureaus all around the world getting you news, you know.
Maybe we'll just see puzzle bureaus around the world for the MYT. Okay, time for some news in brief. Gary Young versus privileged journos. This is former Guardian journalist Gary Young. He delivered an inaugural Rosemary Hollis Memorial Lecture this week. In it, he highlighted how limited the lived experiences are of his fellow journalists and how that's led to a limited understanding of the problems people face. Chris, good analysis.
I really enjoyed that speech. I thought it was very interesting, very well put, very quotable. And I think there's a lot to it. Yeah, there's a problem that journalism has just as an industry generally, as a concept, I suppose, that you've got people trying to report dispassionately about what they see, but always people's experience, people's biases, what people think is worthy of being a story, all influences it. And that, but it's always positioned as a completely, you know, dispassionate, clinical look at the world as it is. You know, that's a great ideal and something that everyone should work towards. Ideally, you mitigate that problem by getting lots of journalists with lots of different experiences, so that everybody can have a sort of say, and you don't have huge blind spots on your staff. All very noble goals, but journalism is also in crisis at the moment, with no money, fewer and fewer resources being spread over further and further outputs, which just creates a sort of perfect storm where you don't end up with this. And where journalism is sort of finding its way and being rewarded, it's for people being specialists in certain areas, or certainly one of them. And again, I should caveat all of this by saying this is certainly my experience and my reading of journalism and the people that I read and the people that I see. And it may well not be the case across the board, but it feels like people are being rewarded for being specialists in certain areas, which is great because then you do get authoritative content from them. But by all means, it's not the be-all and end-all of everything going on in that world. So it spirals out very quickly as soon as you start to think about it. And I think, Gary raises some really interesting points.
I think the thing that made me reflect on was the demise of the likes of BuzzFeed, Huffington Post, Vice. You know, these are outlets for young journalists to make their mark, to learn their trade, and they are essentially disappearing from the UK landscape, and that is really, really sad. And I think it goes to Gary's point. I mean, Shirin Kala wrote about this brilliantly in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago. She used to work at Vice, and she was saying, I'm about to give a lecture to young journalism students, and I don't even know if I can recommend the industry to them. I don't know whether I can do that in good faith because the industry might let them down. And you're right. I think there's this sort of perfect storm of circumstances, and it makes me really, really sad about the future of our industry. And I really hope that young journalists can find other avenues to getting their work noticed, and mainstream established newspapers or other media outlets can tap into talent in different ways.
Because it's difficult, Chris, isn't it? Because you can... So a lot of places have had schemes or have tried to think about this and tackle this, some better than others. And then actually when redundancies come in, that sort of goes out the window, because anything you've put in place, the people you've helped put in place can suddenly disappear because someone else is looking at it all.
Yeah.
And that can be pretty devastating. This can have an even bigger effect on trying to create a diverse workforce.
Again, it's whether sort of like the legacy institutions are the people to change it, whether they can. Trying to diversify your staff, trying to create programs that benefit new grassroots journalists from different walks of life, these are all very good, but perhaps the system can't be changed. perhaps any work that's done from the top down that way won't create lasting change that can weather, you know, periods of economic turmoil or, you know, international events that need sort of serious, somber legacy reporting. Maybe they do. It's such a hard thing to do that. It makes my mind melt to think about what the alternatives might be. There's been lots of very interesting things grow up from the ground of people, you know, working as independent journalists and creating useful, resonant work. But so then sometimes without the brand recognition of somewhere big, I'm trying not to name names, but you know, does it reach enough people? Is it a lot of effort for very little dial movement? And these legacy institutions aren't going to try and fund the places that will take them over and subsume them. So it's not in their interest to do that. That's perfectly reasonable and legitimate. I'm not suggesting they need to sort of dig their own graves here.
But also they've got to create their own future as well in some of that too. The danger is you're purely self-motivated. If you don't start to fix some of those problems, you won't resonate with your audiences and grow your own businesses.
But how does that happen? You know, so the Murdoch Empire tried to buy into Vice and do that and sort of create a kind of next generation of young journalists, find that, be part of that story. And it's not helped or worked and arguably made it much worse.
And we've just got time for the media quiz. This week it's entitled Radio 4 Battleships. So after Radio 3's announcements last week, Radio 4 has changed up its schedule. So I now invite you to play Battleships, sort of. Okay, here we go. I'm going to name a day and a time, and you tell me occupies that slot on the new look schedule. Taking effect this spring. Buzz in with your names if you know the answer. So Jake, you will say
Jake.
And Chris, you will say
Chris.
Let's play Radio 4 Battleships. Mohit, if you're listening, this is available to license. Question number one. Wednesday at 4 p.m.
Jake.
Yeah.
Oh, Chris.
I think I said Jake as well there.
Jake, you just got there.
That's got to be the media show, hasn't it?
It is.
Yeah. The name we don't speak on
Nemesis.
This podcast. Yeah, yeah. And it's being bumped up to an hour as well, isn't it?
It's going to be an hour long and be visualised. What a concept. Visualised media programme. Yes, well done, Radio 4. Okay, question number two. 11 a.m. on Sundays.
Chris.
Chris.
Is that Desert Island Discs?
So it's not quite Desert Island Discs.
No.
Do you want to buzz in?
I don't know the points for me.
This is the Archer's Omnibus.
Right, okay.
Probably the most controversial change. It's booted later by Desert Island Discs.
Yeah.
A good choice.
I think... Oh, they can do what they want. I'm just annoyed I haven't got the points. I don't care. Move it back so I get the points. That's what I want.
Surely, Jake, it's available on BBC Sounds to catch up on.
Well, I mean, that's the great thing about the Archers. It's built this whole new audience on BBC Sounds, and young people are going to it. And
no, they're
yeah,
not.
They are.
They're bringing it.
I spoke to young people who have become Archers super fans.
It's coming. It's there. They're putting it on Sounds at midnight. So there's obviously people waiting up late.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
They're coming in from the pub. They're coming in from the clubs, and they're getting the Archers on. It's happening. They wouldn't do it otherwise.
I'd almost like to work to become the Radio 4 controller just to screw around with the Archers, just for fun. And finally, question number three, 8 p.m. on Tuesdays. We're getting to the weeds now. 8 p.m. on Tuesdays.
I honestly don't know the answer to
this. Well,
question.
It's still File on 4, the investigations program, though now it's extended to 42 minutes. And Jake, as your prize, you get to work with Talk TV on their YouTube ambitions. So come back with some ideas next time. And how can people keep up with your writing, Chris?
I write Popbitch every Thursday, so you can sign up at popbitch.com.
And Jake?
Deadline.com. And I'm at Jake_Cantor on X.
Lovely. Great to see you both.
Thanks. Thank you.
Well, that's it today from the Media Podcast. Remember, you can get 25% off your first booking at the London Podcast Studios, where we film the show. All you need to do is use the code MEDIAPOD. Just head to thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off when you use the code MEDIAPOD. And of course, if you're new to the show, make sure you've hit follow in your podcast app of choice to get this every week. And you can see what we look like on the YouTube channel as well. My name is Matt Deegan. The producer was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. And I'll see you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Tsinis.
Kayla Tsinis. I'm Kayla Tsinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.